Very good. It's now 8 o'clock, so time to start. And for today's talk, I remember last night I was mentioning just some of the different types of meditation. People had asked me a question on kasina meditation, and also I did mention about the loving kindness meditation. The kasina meditation is very rare that people practice that with success, and simply because it does take a lot of strong imagination, and sometimes people can't even watch their breath. And to imagine a light, you usually draw a light in front of you, or a little circle of white light or blue light, whichever light is you feel an attraction towards. And then you stare at the light, you close your eyes and imagine the light in your mind's eye, stare at the light again, sort of close the eyes, imagine the light. It takes a lot of practice until you can visualize that light inside your, with closed eyes, and the light doesn't move, doesn't change. It's stable. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but some people manage to do that. If you can do that, then by watching it for long enough, you can't be thinking about things or imagining or trying to control. You have to learn how to have a stable awareness of a light. And then after a while, that light will grow naturally. It will turn from the visually imagined light into a nimitta. So it goes actually quite fast to a nimitta, but it does take a lot of skill to be able to do kasina meditation, which is one of the reasons why very few people actually do it. And it's much more helpful, I've always found, in all these years I've been teaching and practicing as well, to do things more gently. And slowly, yes, but why do people want to be in a rush? When you want to be in a rush, when you want to go fast, is the sense of desire there and wanting. And that sense of desire and wanting is a hindrance. And that sense of desire and wanting is actually what stops you or slows you down from going inside and disappearing. So little by little, I always preferred to teach just the body scan meditation to get the body really comfortable, and then teaching the breath meditation. But it's not just the breath meditation, which you've heard me teach. It's also just learning what the present moment is like, what silence is like. What I say is the establishing of mindfulness as the priority of the Satipatthana. Get that mindfulness very strong. And that also means you're lessening the hindrances. When the hindrances are weak and the mind is strong and stable, then you can watch the breath very easily. And a lot of time, actually, you don't even watch the breath. The breath comes to you. And I've talked to many people who meditate, and that is always, when the breath comes to you, it's always gentle and soft and easy to watch. If you try and find the breath, it's usually unpleasant. You can still work that way when you go looking for your breathing, but then when you first find it, it's always a little bit uneven and rough and coarse. But if you soften the mind first of all, then the breath comes into you. And it's usually a much more preferable way to do the breath meditation. Yes, sometimes you have to be more patient. But that's one of the things we're developing anyway, this wonderful patience. The best things come slowly. The thing I mentioned, I'm not quite sure if it was in the interviews yesterday afternoon or in the questions. Like when you grow a plant, you put the seed into the ground, and you can't put fast fertilizer on top of the plant, trying to make it grow quicker. You can't put too much water on it, so it drowns. And you can't have sunlights on it during the night time, so it gets sunshine all day and all night. You have to let it just be natural, be patient. And you never know when that flower is going to bloom. It doesn't announce it, I'm going to bloom today. It comes when the courses are ready. And no one can really predict that. So little by little we understand by watching nature that we can't predict or hasten when a flower blooms. We can't decide when the mangoes are going to ripen and drop from the trees. All we can do is be patient, be still, and then these things happen. So with things like casinos, if you've got a tendency for that, and that often means, to be quite frank, you've done that meditation in the past, then, fine, go for it. But if you haven't done it in the past, you just haven't been successful yet with the breath meditation or with the ordinary meditation, and you want to do something different, to see if that works, it's just like trying too many different recipes rather than a simple one, sticking with it and allowing it to work. But with the breath meditation and the loving kindness meditation, that was very powerful, because with loving kindness, it's not loving kindness to beings, it's even loving kindness to things. And that loving kindness to things is, as a scientist, I don't know how on earth that happens, when you have loving kindness even to machines, it tends to work. And very often, you've been in a difficult situation. I remember even when I went to Oslo once, and I had, the plane was a little bit late, and I had to give a talk somewhere and wondering whether I'd make it in time. And in the car park, those boom gates which go up and go down, there was something wrong with them. They weren't going up. People had paid their parking fees and stuff, but the boom gates still wouldn't go up. So someone asked me, said, "John Brown, come on. We need it." And it came up. It was a nice introduction to visiting ourselves. Oh yeah, we can invite you back again whenever anything else happens, because sometimes the mind does have power. And loving kindness is one of the easiest ways and greatest ways to get that power. And you can put that on machines as well. And I still remember the old concrete mixer which I had when we first came here, sort of 38 years ago. And we bought a concrete mixer because, we were doing so much work, it was worth buying it. And because I was the main builder, it was basically my concrete mixing machine, just with petrol driven. And so often, no one else could get it to work. And this is honestly that sometimes they'd pull the string and it wouldn't work, they'd jiggle this and jiggle that, still wouldn't work. And I'd come to that concrete mixer and I would just be kind to it. I'd actually stroke it, there you are. And it would work first time. And that happened so many times. It was not coincidence. The kindness, I'm not quite sure how it works, but it does seem to interfere, with the machines. I am not sure. But nevertheless, if you can work on a machine, how can kindness help you with your bodily health? And of course you know it can. You've got an ache or pain somewhere. Instead of having fear, fear creates some tension in your body. The body scrunches up and it gets inflamed. When you let things be, of course that kindness will make things very loose. And blood and lymph and whatever else is flowing through your system can actually flow easily. So that kindness, you can see it in your body. I know this is an old story, but when I was a kid, we lived in council flats in a poor part of West London, and I spent most of my youth playing soccer, not in parks, but it's just in the backyards, which was all stone and concrete down the street. And so very often you went for a tackle and you scraped the skin off your knees. And it was only a kid, 6, 7, 8 years of age, and it hurt and you were crying, there's blood on your leg. And just my mum would just come run to me, and then she would bend down and she would kiss the wound. And the pain would always go away straight away. And just put a band-aid on, and it would never ever get infected. So if any of you work as a nurse in the hospitals, instead of wasting money on antiseptics and goodness knows what else, and painkillers, just but that's exaggeration, that last comment about if you're a nurse in hospitals, but it does actually work. And I'm sure you've experienced that, and if someone is very close to you and kind to you, and they give you some sort of blessing, or you do it for yourself, and then the aches and the pains, they kind of vanish. It's weird, but I think it must be because the kindness affects the mind, and the mind tells the brain to relax. And the brain does that, and just the aches and pains tend to lessen and sometimes totally disappear. And that's one of the reasons why, to overcome hindrances, one of the greatest antidotes I've always found is loving kindness. It's not just trying to put more effort in, or trying to change my posture, or trying to get a perfect environment, and all the people who make noise and bang this and drop that, you have to send them out. Get a perfectly quiet environment. Because I notice if you have to do that, everyone who coughs, everyone who drops something, everyone who makes a noise has to leave. I'll be one of the first to leave to make it fair. But no, instead of forcing, controlling and making things happen, loving kindness is the opposite. Loving kindness is allowing things to happen, not making them happen. And I always find that if ever there's a problem in my meditation, if ever you get so far, hey, what? It usually just goes past this easily. What's going on? One of my first antidotes to use is like a loving kindness. I care for whatever I'm watching. And I don't know how many times that just a little memory, not of having a whole philosophy about it or saying so much, just a simple suggestion, just care. And then that usually fixes the problem. And I remember once somebody here, quite a few years ago, they came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, what is the antidote if you have all the five hindrances together? One big hit of every hindrance that ever was, full power hitting you. You mean sloth and torpor and restlessness at the same time? And like and dislike? But what they meant is, I'm sure you know, that sometimes the meditation is difficult and sometimes the more you try and overcome it, the worse it gets and it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's why I always emphasize what I call the Nalagiri strategy. And the story of Nalagiri, if you know that story, that one of, it's a Buddha's cousin and wanted to basically get rid of the Buddha. And so arranged to have this elephant, this big elephant, sort of get drunk. And once the elephant was drunk, he let it loose down the roads where the Buddha and his disciples, his monks, were walking on arms round. And having been grown up in a city like London, there were still many of those very narrow streets. Those streets were made for horses, not for big cars. And I could imagine that would be the same in India 2,500 years ago. They were made mostly for walking, not for big vehicles. So they'd be very narrow. And when a monk or somebody was walking there, there was, number one, very little place to hide, and number two, very narrow. So when all these people could see this elephant charging down, smashing everything in the path, and killing people too, you can imagine there was no way really to hide. So they told the Buddha, turn around and run. And all the other monks left and ran, except for the Buddha and his faithful attendant, Ananda. And this was the cute part of the story, which I don't know, you've heard me say it before, but I kind of thought this was really quite sweet. Ananda wouldn't run away. He stood in front of his teacher, the Buddha. "Let the elephant kill me. I will sacrifice my life for the Buddha." It's really quite cute, isn't it? How many of you would do that for me? Would you run away and say, "Let the big truck, you know, coming down the road, Jhanagrove"? It's quite a steep hill, this, from the gate down to here. So sometimes some of those trucks might just, you know, lose control. If I was walking along there, would you say, "Let him take me"? The Buddha just pushed him out of the way. "It's okay, Ananda, I can handle this." Of course. But it was a very nice gesture and it went down in history. So then you had this scenario. You can imagine this really peaceful, pure-hearted, wise, kind Buddha. And this elephant who was drunk, who was really powerful. And they were going to meet together, come closer and closer. And I often mention here that the Buddha did have great powers. So the Buddha could have, you know, you've seen these kung fu masters, and this would be so much better than a kung fu master. Anyone here can do kung fu? Some of you can. You know, once when I was visiting my mother in UK, and I was going to the Sri Lankan temple that evening to give a talk, and I took, you know, a shortcut. I knew the area because I grew up there. But I made a mistake because the shortcut which I took was past this housing estate. And it was known as a bedrock, let's say, what do you call it? Like a hotbed of crime. So many unemployed people were staying there. And their kids never had jobs, never had much hope in society at that time. And so in the evenings they would congregate just out at the entrance to this housing estate, just looking for some mischief to do. They were violent. And so when I saw them, I thought, oh, yeah, in my day they didn't have these sorts of gangs. But now they were there. And it was about, I don't know the number now, that's beyond my memory, but it would be about a dozen or 13 or something of these hoodlums. And when they saw me, they recognized I was a Buddhist monk. So they looked at me, and as I was walking closer to them, and they started chanting, "Buddha, Buddha, 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 Buddha." As I was getting closer, it was getting faster and getting louder. "Buddha, Buddha, Buddha." It was like intimidation, trying to make me scared. But, you know, I knew this area, and I didn't have fear. I could have crossed the road to the other side of the road or turned back and gone another way. But I didn't want to do that. I really ran a mad monk because what I did, I lifted up my hands. The only kung fu I ever saw was on that TV program before I became a monk called Kung Fu. Remember that one, the kung fu? What was his name? I think his name was Kane, wasn't it? Yeah. Oh, well, you really know that better than I do. But anyway, I never done kung fu, but I saw that movie. It was a TV show, and then I made my kung fu pose. And as I got closer, Buddha, 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 and they stopped. And you know, they parted to let me go through. And I carried on through. Only afterwards I thought, that was a close one. If any of them had done anything, I'd have been wasted. But it made a good story, and I'm very happy for that story. It's amazing how you... Because, I mean, you can imagine the psychology. They saw like a brown robe, bald head, just, you know, looked like a kung fu master. And they brought it. But anyway, So, the Buddha could have done anything to that elephant. I often say he could have just grabbed its trunk. You know, a huge elephant, they're very heavy. Grabbed its trunk and once, twice, three times around its head, around the Buddha's head, and then over the Ganges River. That'd have been easy. But that would have been violent. And that's not the way of a Buddhist. Certainly not the great master, the Buddha. Not any monk or nun. And not you. Instead, he'll use this beautiful loving kindness. The way I remember teaching it was he would say to that elephant, with his mind, Nalagiri, now you can pick me up with your trunk if you wish and smash me against one of the walls. You can trample me under your heavy feet, or you can push me over with your body and so I get killed against a tree. Whatever you do, Nalagiri, the door of my heart will always be open to you. I will never be angry or wish revenge on you. Nalagiri, may you be at peace. Now that's only just a fraction of the power of those words when they're spoken of by a Buddha. Powerful. And according to the story, you're just thinking those loving kindness words or something similar. And the elephant stopped and put his head in front of the Buddha so the Buddha can stroke him. There, Nalagiri. There, you know, it wasn't your fault. You know, sometimes people make you drunk and make you do those things. And so Nalagiri had his trunk sort of stroked. And that was the end of the confrontation. And to me, that inspires me. That's what you do with hindrances. Don't go fighting and trying to destroy them once and forever. If you have all these hindrances come up, say, they're a hindrance. They're hatred, desire, sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt, all together. There, that's fine. You can come into my heart. I will never try and harm you at all. It's the reaction you have to what you experience that determines whether it's meditation or not. If it really is meditation, you see these things, you don't react with ill will. You don't make hindrances out of hindrance. You're not angry about anger. You're not restless about your restlessness. I've been restless all week. I want to get rid of it. Let it stay. Let it be. Be kind to your restlessness, your sleepiness. Be kind to it. And then you find it weakens and then vanishes. And it's a powerful experience when you feel that how you'd expect, you know, as in the world to overcome problems, doesn't work in meditation. That's one of the reasons why we just sit there and just watch and be kind. When you do those things, of course, the breath comes up. If the mind doesn't want to watch the breath, fine. You don't go forcing your attention on things. There are some days when you have good meditation. There are some days when you don't. You can't have good meditation every day. That's one of the reasons why I developed this simile. And it was a simile of the migrant. I haven't told a simile yet on this retreat, but you've heard it before because it actually stands as a joke all by itself. But it's not really a joke, it's actually telling you something. A migrant came to Australia. He was like a doctor, very well educated in his home country. But when he came here, the only job he could get was on a building site. He was strong, efficient. He worked really hard the first day. When he got home, his wife asked him, "How much did you earn today at work?" He said, "Nothing. They didn't pay me anything. Oh, they exploited me." You know, that sometimes people do exploit migrants. So he went there on Tuesday and on Wednesday, same happened. Worked really hard, didn't get anything. He wasn't going to go to work on Thursday, but nothing much to do, so he went there on Thursday, again worked really, really hard, and didn't get even a cent of pay. And on Friday, you know, he was just really fed up, but again, nothing much to do, so he went to work on Friday. And on Friday, he didn't work hard at all. But his boss gave him a big pay packet, and he left work early with all the other workers. And he went home and told his wife, he said, "Look at all the money I made today. I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to work on Fridays." And that's what it's like when you say, "I'm not getting good meditation today. Yesterday was okay, but not today." Why not? You don't get paid every day. You accumulate your credit. And when the credit's enough, you get the paycheck. And those of you who complain, you've been really meditating all week, and even at the end of the retreat, you still haven't got a paycheck. The check is in the mail. Whatever it is. It comes eventually, it has to, it's just cause and effect. But little by little that shows you that just we're patient enough. And it always happens, I don't know how many people have told me this, that when the paycheck comes, you don't expect it. You say, "No, everything seemed to be nice and peaceful and I tried to meditate, didn't get anywhere." But then I just, you know, just after, before lunch, nothing else to do, so I just sat in my room. I sat on the stupa and just closed my eyes. Wham, bam. Wow, that was beautiful. Why? You've done all the hard work already, you got a big credit, and it's just waiting for the paycheck to arrive. And it arrives when you don't expect it. That's so true. When it comes, "Ooh, where did this come from?" After you come out. But when it does start to come, now you realize you've got very strong mindfulness. That's one of the parts of the deep meditations which I have to emphasize again and again and again. Because sometimes people are just, you know, you go into a trance. But before you're going into, you know, those deep meditations, it's not a trance at all. Your mindfulness gets very strong. So we can see the things like the breath, but not just the breath, as I said earlier, you know, just the beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. Wow, that's amazing. A whole breath. Look at my finger. You are going into jhanas. No, don't use hypnosis. So, but there's something similar with hypnosis. I remember, you know, Dennis, you know, used to do hypnosis and get people into their previous lives, and some of them were true. So anyway, when you have things like, you know, hypnosis, how does it work? Now, first of all, you know, you have to trust the person so you feel safe. That's why, you know, you try and make sure you feel safe with me, even though, you know, I said I don't know Kung Fu. Actually, I don't know Kung Fu. I will not hit you. Some of you may deserve to be. No, you don't. So you feel safe here and protected. Nice food, good people, people who keep precepts. That feeling of safety is important. So it allows you to relax. When you start to relax, you know, you hear these soft words. And in meditation, no meditation teacher says, "Sit up! Don't do this! Watch the breath! Watch the breath! How many times do I have to tell you? You have to watch the breath from the beginning to the end, and don't tell me you can't do it. You're a human being. I could do it. You can do it. Why can't you do it?" You don't talk like that. Instead, you talk kindly. To get past your psychological defenses and feel this is a lovely thing to do. It's a peaceful thing to do, a kind thing to do. My job is actually to do the marketing campaign for you. So afterwards, well, this sounds nice. So you go for it. And little by little, just you'll find, the more you actually you feel safe and trust this process, the less of a restless mind you will have. The restless mind is just trying to avoid this simple process of turning off. The deep meditations are a default state. They're like turning off all the switches in your mind, like turning off your computer. And as you turn off the computer more and more, these teachings are not to be sneezed at. I'm sorry, I'm only joking. You can sneeze as much as you want. And little by little, you know, you find you allow it to happen. You don't do meditation, you let meditation happen. You get out of the way. The mind actually wants to sink into deep meditation. Now, especially if it's had any taste of it before, it's really attractive. You don't push it into the deep meditation, you allow it to happen. It does it by itself. That's a weird thing. If you get some deep meditations, you know, you'll realize you didn't do it. You didn't make it happen. It's not your possession. Possessions are what you work for and you earn. Fine. It's not work and earn. It's what happens when you don't do things. It's like the default state of the mind. Because it's a default state of the mind, it means that all computers, they're fast, they've got so many programs, so many apps on them, whatever, all computers, new ones, old ones, the fastest ones, they can all be turned off. Every human being has the turn the power off button to let go and be still and disappear. That's why each one of you, you know, the jhanas, enlightenment, it's all possible for each one of you. Whether it will happen or not depends how much confidence and trust you have in sitting and allowing it to happen. And you know, thanks for, you know, someone like some of the great teachers I had. You can read this in the suttas, but in some of the suttas, the Pali, you know, is. Sometimes you don't have a feeling for the Pali. It's not just knowing the translation, looking in a book and translating it word for word. It's actually understanding the meaning of it and where it all fits in, why it fits in. Even something I say that's about the word Nibbana. It's an important word, isn't it? And well, one of the places where you understand the meaning of the word Nibbana, you know, it was from things like the Ratana Sutta. You know, all you Sri Lankans there, you chant that when you were a kid. Nibbanti dira yatayang padipo. That's one of the lines in the Ratana Sutta. It's going to Nibbana. Now, I'm using that as an English verb. You know, like you, it's going to Nibbana as a verb. It's going to, like, do this or do that, it's going to Nibbana, just like a lamp Nibbanas. A lamp, it just, or I like to adapt that to a candle. It's a candle is lit, it has a flame. What is the flame of a candle? What actually is it? It's the result of three things, three causes. The wax in the candle, the wick going through the candle, and the heat, which makes the fuel burn on the wick. Those three things. The wax, the wick, and the heat. And if any one of those three things is exhausted, no more wax left, the wick, it's exhausted, burnt out. Or the wind blows the flame away, blows the heat away. What happens to the flame? it's extinguished. It doesn't go anywhere. If it's been a good flame, it doesn't go to the heaven where all flames live happily ever after. Nor does it go to a hell realm where it's been a naughty flame and burnt things. It is, what happens to the flame? They have a word for it in Pali. It nibbanas. When I saw that, I thought, wow. Even kids who had no interest in meditation would know what the word nibbana meant. It was an ordinary word which the Buddha used to show things which are exhausted. The process ends. It doesn't arise again. When you see that, woo, all the theorizing of what nibbana should be, what you'd like it to be, what your credible philosophical mind would sort of argue it to be. You see, simple people, kids, Johnny, the flame's nibbana, just go and light it again. Kids will know what it meant. So little by little, so if you learn the simplicity of this path. And what I really love is when you, oh, there's this one guy. He was he was a farmer, and he was from the northeast, because that's where I grew up. And this farmer in the northeast, he was just getting some supplies in the town of Sokonokon, where there was this big ceremony in one of the temples. It just happened to be the cremation of Ajahn Mun. He didn't know Ajahn Mun, who he was or anything, but he saw all these monks, and the monks were quite impressive about this funeral. And he listened to them, and he heard one of the monks say, all you need to do is sit a lot and walk a lot to get enlightened. And then he was so impressed, but he didn't really understand the Dhamma very much, a simple farmer. But that was enough. You know, he renounced and became a monk, and that's all he ever did. On his walking path, he would just walk. When he got tired, he would sit down and meditate. When his meditation was restless or he thought he had enough, he'd get up and walk again. And even this, it was only outside and on a sandy path. And even when he felt sleepy, he would just lay down on the sandy path and just sleep there. So that's what he ever did. Another enlightened being soon arose. It's wonderful to see the simplicity of that practice. Because sometimes I think that we give too much instructions, give too much information. Number one, it makes you confused. Number two, you compare that with other teachings which you've heard. Which is the best? Which is the right? The ones which work are the ones which are the right for you, which makes you peaceful and still. So little by little, we meditate, and each one of you will get some days, some moments really peaceful. Guaranteed all your money back. Actually, that's not true. That's why I said when I wrote all these books on meditation, I think I said even one of them in the introduction, if it doesn't work, if you read the book and maybe after 6 months or a year you're not enlightened, you can always ask for your money back. And that's a guarantee. You can ask for it back. You won't get it. But you can always ask. But little by little, there's so much great teachings and little tips, just like using the kindness anywhere when you're meditating. So yesterday I said about using the kindness on the breathing. Wow. I remember talking to one very senior monk about that, not in our monastery, but he's very well known. He said, no, you can only do loving kindness on beings, on like human beings or even heavenly beings if you want, on ants and even spirits and stuff, but not on things. And we said, well, I can do loving kindness on things like cement mixers and it works. You know that anybody into really IT fixes up computers? Quite a few of you. But this is actually a true story. And it's one of those stupid stories, but it's amazing. That one of our monks over in the United States, an American monk, no, he's actually Canadian. I don't personally know him, good friend. But anyway, he was receiving a Thai monk at the airport. And so the Thai monk, when he arrived, the Ajahn Pasano just wanted to check he's got the right visa in his passport. And he looked at the visa he's got and looked again. How on earth did he get a visa like this? He's a Thai monk, a simple forest monk. And he's got a visa, a diplomatic visa, with no expiry date for the rest of his life to come into the United States whenever he wants. It's a pretty neat visa. In the time of Homeland Security. So how on earth did he get this visa? And he told the story, and it's true, it's checked out many times. He just happened to be visiting a Thai monastery in Houston, Texas. And one of the Thai people who supported the place was an IT engineer employed by NASA in their headquarters in Houston. And they just installed this new multi-hundred million dollars, new computer. And the best they could possibly get, all funded by the government. And once they'd installed it, they couldn't get it to work. And every hour it was down, it was costing them $1 million or something. So they flew experts from the whole of North America, first class, come immediately to try and fix up the problem. Nothing worked. I love these stories. And one of the Thai engineers, at the guy was saying, said, it just so happens that there's this Thai monk, forest monk, very simple, who happens to be in Houston right now. And he's here, and monks and nuns, we're really cheap. It is true. And so he said, all you need to do is, you know, give him a can of Coca-Cola or something, and he'll come and see what he can do. It's not much of a cost, not compared to some of these other experts. So anyway, they invited the monk in, you know, gave him all the security to get into the top security part of NASA's headquarters. And once in there, he just said, I'll just do some meditation for a little while and then some chanting. I don't know actually what he did. I think he did the chanting first and then the meditation. Because as soon as he came out of meditation, and his meditation object was loving kindness. As soon as he came out, of course, that computer worked perfectly. And they were so grateful. I never expected this, but they basically had nothing to lose, you know, a can of Coca-Cola or something. That's what it cost them. And they got this big multi-million dollar computer to work perfectly. And so, it's just, some people say it wasn't out of gratitude. Apparently he said they were grateful to me. They wanted me, you know, to give me something which, because it was NASA, they could actually get this visa for him. But afterwards I thought maybe that was just selfishness. If ever they needed him again in a hurry, he would have had this visa which would never expire. But it was a kindness, which is fantastic, what it can do. So little by little, how do we generate that? You feel it. A lot of times, you know, I can give you instructions. You can read instructions from somewhere else. You can read instructions, you know, from the suttas. But you feel it works. You know, you do something, it's like the old trial and error. You know, if you know you may have a toothache, okay, be kind to it. Did that work? No. There wasn't kindness. Expand that kindness, experiment with it. See, you know, that's why I say things like, open the door of your heart to that pain. Really, you can stay for the rest of my life, even get worse. I will never try and control you. Get rid of you, you're part of me. And if it really is loving kindness, it's like letting go. It works. And that's when you know, yes, you've done it. That was loving kindness. You make mistakes again in the future, but at least you're learning what actually works. One of the problems is when you want to get rid of problems, even like hindrances. Now let it go. My tiredness, the door of my heart's open to you. You can stay as long as you want and do things like this. And then you think, why haven't you gone yet? How long do I have to do this loving kindness business before you go? I thought, for everything you've said, actually, brother, the whole retreat, and I still haven't got charters. Of course, you can see the problem, can't you, now? It's you're not really letting go. You're not really opening the door of your heart to everything. It's another strategy, another business deal. I'll let go if you let me be peaceful. That's not letting go at all. So little by little, we learn how to overcome those hindrances. And your mind does become peaceful. It has become peaceful. Don't need to think, is this peaceful enough? Is this nimittas? Is this jhanas? Is this whatever? Please don't think that. Don't ask questions. A good rule of thumb. If you're in a state of deep peace, and you ask yourself, is this jhana? Can't be. You can't think in jhana, you can't give things names. Afterwards you can, but not in it. In it you're too peaceful, too silent. You know the word, actually the real word, noble silence? The way it was used by the Buddha, not by the way it was used by meditation retreats, was actually for the second jhana. But it's so quiet, you can't even think, you can't will. It's frozen. Beautifully so. That's actually why, in the meditations, you can't form any idea, any concept, but you're perfectly aware. That's hard to understand, but that's actually when you come out afterwards, that's how you can explain it. So anyway, let's go back a bit. How do you get into those states? More advice, Ajahn Brahm. Of all the meditations, as I said on the question time, that was the only meditations which the Buddha praised. First, second, third and fourth jhana. Nothing else. Not even the immaterial states. Just those four. Because that's actually the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. Always consistently described as those four jhanas. And there's no thinking possible there. And lay people in the time of the Buddha would experience those. There was this one of the Buddha's well-known disciples. His name was Jitta, and he used to be a general before in the military. And this fellow, Jitta, you know, he gave up any violence, became a disciple of the Buddha, and became a non-returner, an anagami. But this Jitta, he went to see one of the other religious leaders at the time, known as Nyataputta, otherwise Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, which also arose at that time. And when he went to see the leader of the Jains, the leader of the Jains said, oh, we've just been discussing something. And look, here is a very well-known Jitta, ex-General Jitta. He was one of the chief disciples of the Buddha. Maybe he can answer this question. Do you really believe that you can stop all thinking in your mind and be still? And Chitta said, no, I don't believe that. There you are, the very well-known disciple of the Buddha himself admits that you cannot stop thinking when you're in meditation. You have to have thoughts. And the leader of the Jain said, to say you can stop thinking, that's like saying that you can put your fist in the Ganges River and stop the current so it doesn't flow. It's just the nature of the mind that has to think. You see, and he admits it. And then Chitta said, what is more reliable, your beliefs or your experience? And Chitta said, I don't believe you can do that. I know you can do that because I get into jhanas, said Chitta. And then the leader of the Jain said, these Buddhist lay people, they're really devious. They can't be trusted. They trick me. But what it meant there, that you know, even lay people, you can achieve those jhanas or can experience them regularly. Why not? Learn how to let go. I think his advantage, he had, you know, the great teacher, the Buddha. It can be done. So how does it actually happen? This is how Ajahn Chah described it. I think I was talking with someone this morning about this, or yesterday. Some of the teachings which I heard, you know, from Ajahn Chah, which at the time I rejected as stupid, unreasonable, can't be. And one of those teachings, I remember hearing the first year I was with Ajahn Chah. And maybe, you know, I wasn't developed enough, I couldn't really understand what he was meaning. When he said Wat Pa Phong was a mango orchard. It wasn't a mango orchard, it was a part of jungle. Villagers had claimed around this little island of jungle, but that little piece of jungle remained there, and that's where Ajahn Chah had his monastery, his forest monastery, Wat Pa Phong. And he said those mango trees were planted by the Buddha. Now come on. Mango trees don't last 2,500 years. No, Bodhi trees maybe, but not mango trees. He said, all those mango trees are healthy and they're dripping with ripe, juicy mangoes. What on earth is he meaning? And he said, you cannot climb the tree to get a mango. You cannot throw a stick up to hit the branch and get the mango to fall. You can't get a ladder to collect those mangoes. There's only one way to get those mangoes. And that one way is you have to sit perfectly still underneath that mango tree. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. That's the only way. Such is the great wisdom and compassion of the Buddha. Yeah, I thought. And I actually forgot that teaching for years. It was rejected. And the other interesting thing was that that teaching was there, but hardly any other monk of that generation, my generation, or especially the Western monks, they didn't give it much importance either. Now, little other teachings, like the little bottle with your loved one's feces in it, they never forgot that one. Or the, you know, the stick is only heavy when you hold it. That one was always remembered. But things like sitting under a mango tree, perfectly still, just with your hand open, that was forgotten. It's one of the reasons I wrote it down as best I could remember it in one of those books. Because I wanted it to be preserved as one of the best teachings of Ajahn Chah. You have to be perfectly still for nimittas and jhanas and enlightenment insights to come. You don't need to do anything. You sit there perfectly still, and the hand open is like the kindness, the metta, the softness, opening the door of your heart, perfectly still. And then these things, they just happen. They fall. That's their nature. If you haven't got enough kindness, of course they don't fall. If you're not still enough, long enough, hasn't come yet, where's it coming? I've only got enough, come on. There's only 2 days left. Ah! Is it 2 days? What day is it today? It's Thursday. You've got Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Yeah, come on, just exaggerate. 2 days. So 2 days, that's 48 hours. 48 times 60. This is 2880. 2,880 minutes. Multiply that by 60. That's almost 150,000 seconds. Just 1 second's enough to get enlightened. You've got so many more chances. Just sit perfectly still with a kind heart, the hand open. And then these things just fall in. Weird. But that's how it works. That's Ajahn Chah's simile. So little by little, when we just say watching a breath or watching whatever, and then joy starts to drip into our mind. The mindfulness is strong, and that's one of its signs. With strong mindfulness, what you see tends to be gorgeous and beautiful. It's not gorgeous, it's not beautiful, it's just suffering. Nothing is perfect out there in the world. But the mind sees it as beautiful. And as the joy gets bigger and bigger, it shows you're engaging more and more. The mangoes are sweeter and sweeter as they fall, more and more juicy. And little by little, then the big, really juicy mangoes fall. And those are like the nimittas. Don't really worry. Is this a nimitta? Is this not a nimitta? Is this a good nimitta? Is there a better nimitta? What should I do next? The answer to what to do next is nothing. There is no next. Just be in this moment. What you have now is good enough. It has to be good enough. That's all you've got. You're here, this moment. That's all there is. Don't try and get something more. Don't try and get rid of things. Just be kind to this moment. That's all you do. Anytime you think, what should I do next? What have I done wrong in the past or whatever? You're missing it. Be in this moment, so free, so peaceful. If you have any doubts, remember your future is being made right now. The past, you don't learn from the past. You learn from the present, from this. And little by little, the mind disengages from past and future. There is no next for you. So the idea, what should I do next? That's the symbol of restlessness. So little by little, we just stay here. In this moment, we're sitting still. And that's when the mangoes start falling. Unexpectedly. Beautiful nimittas come. When they come, what should you do next? Nothing! You've got a nice nimitta, enjoy it. Many people don't get nimittas. You've got one, yay! In other words, don't try and improve. When you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. That's an old saying. I love that saying. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So just forget about the future. Don't want anything. Just enjoy this moment. A moment free from wanting. Free from the control of desire. You're free. And that freedom, that contentment, that makes our mindfulness really strong. And the mindfulness really strong gives you the joy and the stillness. And that builds. It is incredible limitless. So peaceful, so powerful. You sometimes wonder, how can something so powerful and peaceful be so still? Because they go together. And it gets even more, it gives you confidence. You don't need to do things. Just be there. And little by little, that gets stronger and stronger. That's where the jhanas come. When you get your first experience of jhana, you think that's amazing, that's the best, you can't get more than that. And that's a weird thing. There's always a second jhana. The next one is more profound than the first. And you think that this is it. That's why, you know, sometimes people get a first jhana and afterwards they think, wow, that's it, I'm enlightened. Of course, you have a good teacher and they bring out some latent defilements and you realize, no, you weren't enlightened after all. But little by little, you realize that. And just be still, be peaceful. It's not about being enlightened. It's about disappearing. Not wanting anything in the whole world, enlightenment or not, being peaceful, being still, nothing there. And that happens to you. And by little, you just sit here, be still, be kind, and wait for the mango to fall. I don't know, there's no mango trees here. It's a wooden ceiling. Ah. They still fall. And a wonderful time. When they do, just enjoy it to the max. Why not? You work so hard. You didn't need to work hard. There's a wonderful thing about meditation. It's a lazy person's spiritual path. It's true. Do you think you're lazy? If you haven't had jhana yet, you're not lazy. You haven't really appreciated what laziness really is. You really go for the max. Totally disappear. No one here. There's no one at home. When there's no one at home, that's pretty lazy. But there's mindfulness really strong. Okay, so I think I better stop now. Sadhu. 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 Okay, hope you enjoyed that.